Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the best in late-night radio. I'm Richard Serrett, filling in for George Norrie. And tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010. That's the amplitude modulation band, friends. Earlier this week, I returned from a road trip with my twin boys, part of a quest to visit all 30 Major League Baseball parks across America. We traveled to Cincinnati and the Great American Ballpark, and it is. Then on to Pittsburgh and PNC. What a jewel. And finally to Cleveland and what used to be and still is in some quarters affectionately referred to as the Jake, Jacobs Field, now Progressive Field. And while I was in Cleveland, I was able to meet up with a Coast regular and a great guy, Jim Harold, of the Paranormal Podcast and Jim Harold's Campfire. What a great night we had talking. And we both agreed it's a shame we don't live closer so we could hang out more often. And I found out today it's Jim's birthday. So happy birthday, Jim Harold, from everyone here at Coast. And happy birthday greetings also go out to another Coast to Coast listener and keeper of the Robert the Haunted Doll, Mary Ann, in San Diego. Hope you had a great birthday, Mary Ann. Back to the road trip, we had some other great adventures along the way, including a side trip to Moundsville, West Virginia, to see the Moundsville State Pen, reportedly one of the most haunted locations in America, and right across the street is the Grave Creek Mound, a burial mound allegedly constructed by the Adena people around, get this, 1000 BC. And the Adenas, according to legend, may have been a race of giants. And of course, while we were back in Cleveland, we also visited the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where on the third floor, you can also cast a vote, or at least vote to have a particular band or artist nominated. So my twins and I, we all voted for the Monkees. We got home just in time to see my lovely bride, the mighty Aphrodite, as she was leaving to depart for Greece, where she's now visiting family. So I want to send out my bear hugs and love to her. There's a good chance she's actually listening on her iPhone and Bluetooth on her car rental as she winds her way through the mountain roads in southern Greece. I miss you, cutie. When I speak with her on the phone, you know, I can hear the hum of the cicadas over there. So that and the bass solo of the bullfrog, someone once said, make for a summer night serenade. If you or someone you know and love has been diagnosed with cancer, maybe you've sat across from your doctor and have been given the devastating news, it's stage four, or even worse, it's time to get your affairs in order. My guest in hours one and two has an important message for you. Well, two really. There's no such thing as false hope. And secondly, statistics do not foretell the future. Rick Shapiro is the author of Hope Never Dies, in which he offers a window into the lives of extraordinary patients and the paths they've taken to defy the odds of the experts. Through their own stories and the group of practitioners who've provided their unique and different approaches to healing, Rick provides an inspiration not only for patients and their families, but a critical message for the conventional oncology community to awaken to the value of a true integrative approach that is too frequently absent in cancer care today. Then, in hours three and four, open lines. If you have a story, sure to raise the hackles on the back of my neck, I'll have a phone line open just for you. Here's to good company and summer nights. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Welcome back to Coast, Richard Serrett filling in for George Norrie. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. Rick Shapiro is a former practicing attorney, a leading consultant, researcher, and educator in the field of safe, evidence-based, integrative, and alternative cancer treatments. He's engaged in deep research about efficacious therapies that are extending and saving lives and enhancing quality of life beyond statistical norms generally found in the conventional cancer world. He collaborates with internationally renowned doctors and researchers and consulted with and coached cancer patients from all over the world. His book is titled Hope Never Dies, How 20 Late Stage and Terminal Cancer Patients Beat the Odds. Rick Shapiro, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Pleasure to be here.
This is personal for you. Your life has been touched by cancer on a number of occasions. Tell me about it.
Yes, that's very true. Well, back in 1996, March 29th to be exact, my father died of cancer. Regarding his story, originally he had breast cancer, which only afflicts 2% of men, 98% of women, in 1986, 10 years before he passed away. And then 5 years later, he was afflicted with prostate cancer. But then again, in 1996, he was told on January 15th that he had a very serious aggressive lymphoma, and his doctor said that we need to bring out the big guns. And what he meant by the big guns was a very toxic and aggressive chemotherapy. My father went through one cycle of chemotherapy, and what I witnessed when he went through that one cycle was horrific, to put it in one word. The nurses didn't think he would survive 24 to 48 hours after that one cycle, and my dad said no more. And I couldn't argue with him after I saw what I saw. Back in those days, I only thought there was one way to deal with cancer, and that was standard of care. And standard of care means chemo, radiation, or surgery. So on February 15th, a month after his one cycle, the doctor said to me, we look at your dad's situation as terminal. And it was a feeling of helplessness and hopelessness that I had, because my dad was an absolutely wonderful man and a wonderful father. March 29th came, and he moved on. He passed away. It was a tough time. It made me start thinking about whether there were other ways besides these very toxic and harsh treatments. And then in 2001, I was going to get more life insurance. And when you get more life insurance, you go through a physical. And the nurse came over to my office and took some blood. And they came back a week later and said, we will give you more life insurance, but we're not going to give you the premier top-notch rates. And I said, why not? And they said, because your liver enzymes are high. And I didn't know what that really meant. So I sent the blood work to my doctor, and he said, yes, your liver enzymes are high, and let's do another blood test. And he said, yes, they are higher than we like them to be. He did an ultrasound, and it indicated that I might have what's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. He did a CAT scan, and it also indicated non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, but no other problems. And my numbers were going higher and higher, and this was over the course of several months. And at this point, I was feeling discomfort right where my liver exists, lower right side of your abdomen. And 12 times a day, I felt like somebody was squeezing my liver in a vise. So I went to a specialist, and the specialist took 8 vials of blood out of me and tested for everything from hepatitis, A to Z, and all kinds of other liver maladies and diseases. And he came back, and there was nothing that showed up in the blood work, but he was concerned because I was feeling physical discomfort every day, and the numbers were in the stratosphere. And he said words that scared me. He said, I want to do a biopsy on your liver. And that sent shockwaves through my body, because I was thinking that, oh my gosh, I'm mortal and I may not be here that long. So I quickly read a couple of books. I said to him, give me 30 days. And if in 30 days I can bring my numbers towards the normal range, we will put off this biopsy. In fact, I went across the hall to talk to my doctor who referred me to the specialist. I said, what do you think? He said, I don't think you have liver cancer, but this is a warning sign. And you want 30 days? Okay, take 30 days. So I read a book by an Australian doctor and a European doctor, and they talked about the power, the profound power of making radical nutritional transformational changes, dietary changes. And I was somebody who liked the old standard American diet. I liked my cheeseburgers piled high with bacon. I liked my French fries. I liked my ice cream in those days. And that's what I ate primarily. But I radically changed my diet, and I went mostly with a plant-based diet. I was drinking 32 ounces of veggie juices per day with everything from broccoli to spinach to arugula to carrots to beets, things like that, kale as well. And I was told that this was going to help me dramatically. Well, guess what? I went back for blood work in 30 days after going on a plant-based diet and eliminating all the confectionery junk that I had eaten, and I love my desserts. I got rid of all the sugar, no more soda pop, and my numbers came down drastically. And within 6 months, they went to normal. It confounded the doctors. They were really surprised. Guess what? I didn't have a biopsy. So I started thinking to myself after this episode that I went through, is it possible to alter the disease process, cancer and or other things, by making major nutritional changes to one's body? And that's something we all have in common. We all eat in this world 2 to 3 meals per day. And it resonated with me, the power of the fork and what we put in our mouths and how it can impact one's health. So yes, those two incidents, my father passing away and the incident regarding the biopsy requested for my liver and how I resolved that issue with nutritional changes, made me start thinking that, you know what, maybe there's something beyond just standard of care or inclusive of, integratively, a standard of care that can save thousands of lives around this planet.
And you don't just write about, obviously, nutrition. You talk about attitude. And, you know, studies have been done on, for example, the power of prayer. And I think the medical community is somewhat divided on this. But I hear many, I'll call them materialists, in the scientific community, the medical community, who say really attitude and prayer don't matter. But you talk to me about attitude and what it means in terms of fighting cancer.
Attitude plays a major role in fighting cancer, without any doubt in my mind. One of the commonalities of the 20 people who I interviewed who were told to get your affairs in order, 19 out of 20 of these people had a fighting spirit. They had a strong attitude about wanting to live. Now, let's be honest. When somebody's told that they have cancer, certainly people become extremely anxious. There's great fear. There's high stress. There's sometimes depression. But it's really important to get past that. And if you can get past that within a few days, a week or 2 weeks, we can harness the power of mind-body science. And it really is a science. But attitude and having that fighting spirit, finding that inner resolve and that inner strength is really powerful and important. There are some people, when they're told they have cancer, who just put their head under a pillow, they draw the blinds, and unfortunately they go into this deep abyss, this depressive abyss. But there are also those who say, you know what, there's got to be something else out there. There has to be other therapies or treatments that are out there. And we've heard of outliers and stories over time of people who are here 25 years later, despite the fact they were told they were terminal. And I want to be that person. So attitude is, in fact, to me, the number one initial foundation one must bring to their inner self before they put together some kind of an approach, a protocol to beat cancer. So yes, it's critically important, Richard.
So you mentioned standard care, and to my mind, when I hear those three things, radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery, it sounds like standard care practices really haven't changed in almost a century. Is that fair to say?
Chemotherapy was invented in the late 1940s. It was derived from something called mustard gas. Mustard gas was something that was used in World War II. And chemotherapeutic utilization as a therapy has not changed that much. Chemo, radiation, and surgery are the three prongs of standard of care, and they have not changed that much. Cardiovascular disease has improved dramatically in the last 50 to 60 years. In fact, the progress has been tremendous in terms of strokes and cardio. But in cancer, the progression has been minimal, and we really have not improved that much in the big picture. We need to do much, much more and rethink how we fight cancer. But that's what people do. It's nothing to write home about, the standard of care that we utilize. A lot of times we'll read in the newspaper that there's a breakthrough, and Most of these so-called breakthroughs concern cell lines or maybe an experiment on mice, but very rarely do they progress to anything which is material in terms of improving cancer lives, longevity, quality of life for people. Very rarely. It really has been, I don't want to call it a total failure, because the diagnostic tools have improved. We can see cancer earlier, but in terms of solving the problem of cancer, we have a very long way to go.
I remember when Richard Nixon declared a war on cancer. So we're losing, aren't we?
Yes, we honestly, in a word, we are losing the war. It was in 1971 when Richard Nixon said we're going to declare war on cancer, and we were going to spend billions and billions of dollars to fight cancer, and it really didn't present much. You can't just throw money at cancer. That, to be fair, cancer is wily. It's complex. It's not just one single mutation that we can go after. There are all kinds of cancers, and it is complex. But we are very rigid, and I think we have a misguided approach in fighting cancer, because we don't bring to the table other treatments and therapies that have proven to work. I personally have met at over 27 conferences nationwide in recent years, easily over 500 people, and I'm only one person, 500 people who were told by major cancer centers across this country, you need to get your affairs in order. You've got 3 months to live. You've got 6 months to live. And that includes some very harsh and lethal cancers, including lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, brain cancer. And these people, many of these people are here 10, 20, 25 years later. However, they didn't just go with a straightforward standard of care. They brought other treatments and therapies to the table. They got their mind in the right place in terms of attitude. They brought a fight to the table, but they were able to find certain types of practitioners who brought other therapies to the table to support the immune system and to cytotoxically fight and go after cancer directly. So improving the immune system, going after cancer in other ways, in addition to or in lieu of strict standard of care.
Can you give me an example of an effective cancer treatment that's not part of the conventional standard of care?
Sure. I'll give you several if you'd like. Number one, nutritional oncological approaches. And when I say nutritional oncological approaches, I'm not talking strictly about just eating broccoli and wild salmon and Brussels sprouts. It goes way beyond that. Nutritional oncological protocols is a very deep science, and there are experts in this country who will look at one's biochemistry. They will look at objective criteria of the individual, and they can look at biomarkers, and they can put together a cancer-fighting plan. And the best cancer-fighting plans are really personalized to the individual. It's not about going with something which might be called a Gerson or a vegetarian or a vegan diet or paleo diets. Those are generic types of diets and approaches, but it must be personalized to the individual. So there's a deep science in the nutritional oncology arena. So that's one approach. And strict adherence, Richard, is extremely important, not just approaching this in moderation. So basically eliminating, there's some commonalities in the nutritional world besides the fact we need to personalize it, but you want to eliminate all kinds of sugar products. You want to eliminate confectionery junk, obviously, a lot of animal protein, anything which has all kinds of pesticides, insecticides, herbicides, things of that nature, alcohol. Those things should be eliminated from one's diet. And it's important to implement a plant-based diet. And if one brings animal protein to the table, pasture-fed cattle, for example, wild-grown fish, not farm-grown fish, poultry, which is also wild to an extent. And these animals need not be fed antibiotics, hormones, and things like that, because what they're fed and what they're injected with, you also eat. Why are they given antibiotics and hormones and growth factor chemicals? Because they want to make the cattle fatter. They want to have them produce milk more quickly. This is not what nature intended. So eating the appropriate foods and avoiding certain types of foods is critical. That's number one. Number two, supplements. Certain types of vitamins and botanicals and herbs. Now, in my opinion, supplements often gets a bad name, a bad rap. Now, you can buy supplements anywhere these days. You can go to your local grocery store and get it all over the internet. But there are supplements when they are presented by sophisticated doctors and herbalists that can be profoundly impactful to help support the immune system and, again, attack cancer. So supplements are not something to be dismissed if they are prescribed by experts. And experts can be integrative oncologists. They can be certain integrative cancer doctors. They can be naturopaths who have a specialty in oncology, or people who are complementary experts in the nutrition field, nutritional oncology, or supplemental oncology.
Rick, let me just jump in here. We'll step away for a quick break, and we'll come back, discuss some other alternative cancer treatments. Rick Shapiro, the author of Hope Never Dies. Astronauts aboard the International Space Station captured a breathtaking image of a massive volcanic eruption that occurred over the weekend. The amazing photograph was snapped on Saturday morning when the International Space Station passed over the uninhabited volcanic island of Reykoke as it rumbled to life and unleashed an enormous plume of ash and smoke into the sky. According to a post from NASA, volcanic monitoring stations measure the height of the plume to be around 8 to 10 miles. And thanks to the remarkable timing of the flyover, the astronauts were able to capture the eruption as it was seemingly nearing its peak, taking on an eerie mushroom cloud shape. And you can check out the photos and the rest of the story for yourself in the highlight carousel, where Sean Latisore, our webmaster tonight, has posted that and many other tantalizing tidbits up at coasttocoastam.com. Genuine hope for late-term and terminal cancer patients when Coast to Coast AM continues. Rick Shapiro is with us, a former practicing attorney, leading consultant, researcher, and educator in the field of safe, evidence-based, integrative, and alternative cancer treatments, and the author of Hope Never Dies, How 20 Late Stage and Terminal Cancer Patients Beat the Odds. Before the break, Rick, you were telling us about various alternative treatments, including supplements and nutrition. Give us a couple of others, and then I want to dive into some of the case studies in the book.
Absolutely. Well, as we mentioned, nutritional protocols, supplementation programs are critical, tailored to the individual. Additionally, mind-body strategies, which is a little bit different than attitude, and mind-body is really important, and mind-body can mean lots of things to different people. It helps reduce stress, reduces anxiety, fear, and depression. It can be related to meditation, music, prayer, humor, stress relaxation techniques, but mind-body is important. And exercise. Exercise is a very important approach, which anybody can really use, and it helps to reduce the decline of muscle mass. It helps bring oxygen-rich blood to the tissues. It reduces fatigue. It reduces nausea. It helps people sleep better. So exercise regimens, mind-body strategies, tailored supplementation programs, and also the nutritional oncological programs. And there's a ton of research out there, a ton of research, epidemiological studies, case reports, clinical research that attest to the fact, and I'm not shy about saying the fact, that these particular approaches, Richard, can be profoundly beneficial integratively with a standard of care program, or alternatively in some cases to save lives and extend lives. And just in brief, what do these things do? They enhance the immune system. They mitigate internal inflammation, and inflammation is a cancer driver. They help regulate something called apoptosis, and apoptosis is a concept known as programmed cell death. And what that really means is making sure cancer cells die when they're supposed to, so they don't live and grow and grow. These things also inhibit something called angiogenesis, and angiogenesis is the process where blood cells feed cancer and bring it fuel. So we want to mitigate the growth of these blood vessels to cancer. It helps detox the body, regulates blood glucose, because cancer is a glutton for glucose, sugar. We want to regulate those things so it's in the normal range, not in a high accelerated range. And it brings about epigenetic changes, which means it upregulates the expression of tumor suppressor genes, genes that attack cancer, and it downregulates oncogenes, and these are genes that promote cancer. Just a quick moment on that. Everybody has a set of genes that they're born with. You can't change your genes, but you can influence, and there are studies that prove this. You can influence whether those genes are turned on or turned off, and a lot of these alternative complementary therapies can bring about those changes, and there are lots of studies that attest to these facts.
I mean, obviously, you dive deep into the research, but there's also, I'm guessing, you've stumbled onto a lot of quackery out there that we have to be cautious about. I mean, how do you separate the wheat from the chaff? Because we hear things like, you know, hydrogen peroxide kills cancer cells and can cure pancreatic cancer and so forth. We hear this practically every month. There's some different new treatment. How do you separate the quackery from efficacious alternative cancer treatments?
That's a great question, because I detest people who are charlatans, who are quacks, who take advantage of the vulnerable with so-called therapies and treatments that are going to be helpful. And when you are told you have cancer, you'll do just about anything to keep living. So, I mean, quite honestly, it's not easy to do. Of course, if you go to lots of cancer conferences, you can discern what works and what doesn't work. But if you also research the studies, there's a website called PubMed.gov, PubMed.gov, which has 27 million studies. It's under the supervision of the National Institute of Health. I don't expect people to go there and do lots of research. But anytime anyone says they have a one-off cancer-killing protocol, one particular herb, one particular botanical, one particular device, 99.99% of the time, those one-off approaches don't work. It requires a multifaceted, systemic approach with the things I just discussed: nutritional supplementation, exercise, mind, body, and even something called progressive chemo, which we can talk about, which is not generic chemo in some cases. And when you have expert integrative oncologists, integrative cancer doctors, naturopaths who specialize in oncology, and these are the types of people you should talk to, not just somebody who threw up a website. When you have this multifaceted approach with sophisticated experts who look at objective criteria, what does objective criteria mean? That means the individual's blood work, tissue samples, things of that nature. So when somebody does a comprehensive evaluation of the host, that's the individual, the person, and brings these tools to the table and brings it with compassion, then we know that we have something that probably works. But there's no one-off. If someone says acupuncture will cure cancer, that doesn't make sense. Acupuncture could be helpful in certain respects, but it takes research. There's no one perfect list anywhere of doctors and therapeutic experts in this realm that everyone can go to. So you need to be careful about people who say they have the cure for cancer or have something that's going to be helpful. But we shouldn't dismiss the fact there are lots of things that can be profoundly beneficial that help save lives beyond the standard of care and inclusive of, integratively, the standard of care.
Your book is filled with, well, there are 20 case studies of patients who have been told either they have terminal cancer or they are late-term cancer patients. In some cases, they've been told, go home, get your affairs in order. There's nothing more to be done. Tell us about Elizabeth.
Sure. Okay. You're talking about, I think, Elizabeth Pankey?
Yes.
Okay. Let me just see if I have any notes regarding Elizabeth. Can you bear with me 1 second?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
The book, again, is Hope Never Dies.
Sure. Okay. Elizabeth Pankey. Elizabeth Pankey had ovarian and uterine cancer with metastasis to the stomach. She was told at one point, you don't have more than a few weeks, maybe 2 months to live. And Elizabeth is now retired, living happily in Ohio. Elizabeth was born in Poland in 1950. She was a very accomplished individual. She was a medical doctor. She had a PhD in experimental pathology, master's degree in physical therapy, and she was a molecular biology expert and an expert in DNA. She had a deep, deep scientific background. In June of 1999, during a gynecological exam, Elizabeth's doctor discovered minor irregular bleeding. In late June, an ultrasound revealed a large tumor on Elizabeth's ovary. And on July 6th, her doctor informed her she had stage 3 ovarian and uterine cancer, which had now spread to the abdomen. Elizabeth said, I was shocked. I was so angry. Why did this happen to me? Elizabeth continued and said, 1 week after my diagnosis, a surgeon removed my ovaries, my uterus, and any visible cancer. I went with the standard chemotherapy for my type of cancer 2 weeks after surgery. They said the chemo would probably take care of the problem. Elizabeth said, I lost all my hair. I was getting Taxol and carboplatin, took nausea medication, and continued to work. The experience was strenuous. She said, my cancer grew aggressively despite the chemo. I developed a tumor in my spleen. A gallon of malignant fluid was pulled out of my abdomen every 5 days, a full gallon.
Wow.
I tried another chemo drug, but nothing good happened. Elizabeth traveled to 5 prestigious cancer centers throughout the United States. She said, I had metastatic cancer. 2 different kinds of chemotherapy didn't work, and the cancer was spreading. They didn't know what to do. Elizabeth then said, at this point in October of 1999, several cancer doctors told me I needed to face reality. It was doubtful that I would make it until Christmas. I was in disbelief, angry, upset, and desperate. I had heard of chemosensitivity testing. I inquired about it, but all of the cancer centers said it didn't work, yet I needed to take action immediately. I was dying, and I had no time to waste. Elizabeth continues and said, I wasn't giving up. I searched the internet and found Dr. Robert Negurny's website. He's an oncologist who also operates a chemosensitivity laboratory in Long Beach, California. I got him on the phone and was very impressed with his opinions and research. I immediately investigated everything he said and decided to send him a fresh sample of my ascites. The ascites was the liquid that they were pulling out of her stomach.
Right, right.
Then Elizabeth said, Dr. Negurny gave me hope. Within a few days, he called me and said, I have a combination that is making the cancer cells just melt away. I flew to California and saw Dr. Negurny the very next day. He drew malignant cells from my abdomen and then injected the chemo into my abdomen directly at the tumors. He wanted direct contact. No other doctor had recommended this procedure. I was anxious but hopeful. He also injected the personalized chemo cocktail into my vein. Then for my second treatment, he drew the fluid out, only about a quart, not a gallon. It looked like the malignant cells were beat up. After the second treatment, which was just 3 weeks into my chemo treatment, there was no more fluid to withdraw. By Christmas, there was no evidence of cancer cells in my body confirmed by scans. I was supposed to be dead by Christmas, but instead my cancer cells were dead. I informed the major cancer centers that I had visited of my wonderful outcome, the fact that the cancer was gone. To my dismay, all they had to say was, lady, you are lucky. Since my successful treatments, I came to accept what is and enjoy the moments in life. I don't have all the answers. My role is to do the best I can in my life every day. You must want to live. I find that cancer patients who do the best become self-advocates, who direct their own therapies versus just going along with their doctors. People should not lose hope. Keep searching. Follow your heart.
So that is Elizabeth, and she would be called a statistical outlier. She beat the odds.
Well, she might be called that, but in my opinion, her survival is based on rational science. Dr. Robert Negurny is one of 2 doctors I'm aware of in the United States who have this profoundly unique chemosensitivity test, where they test the actual tissue sample of the individual against 15, 16 different chemos and chemo combinations. They don't go with just the off-the-shelf generic methodology used for different cancers. For example, there's the National Comprehensive Cancer Network in this country, which your conventional doctors utilize. It is a consortium of 27 of the top cancer centers in the nation, and they make recommendations about what chemo to use for different types of cancer, but frequently they don't work. So how could you get more personalized than using the actual tissue sample of the individual than something off the shelf? Off the shelf is not personalized. It's not customized. So you could call her an outlier, certainly. People will. But Dr. Negurny has had tremendous success in this area because he utilizes a test attuned to the individual. But she's doing wonderful. Many years later, she was told by 5 cancer centers she had 2 months to live back in October of 1999.
So then, Rick, why isn't progressive chemotherapy part of the standard of care?
It's unfortunately great, big monolithic industrial complexes move glacially slowly. And they don't buy in to a lot of novel treatments and therapies. It's hard to explain why, although Harvard University recently did a test on Gurney's work and said that what he does works. But it's change moves at a glacial pace, and it's terrible that a lot of these therapies that may be considered novel or not part of conventional care are not utilized. It's hard for me to explain why, because I know of oncologists who say that McGurney may be the most brilliant oncologist in the country. And I've seen McGurney speak at conferences. I've talked to him one-on-one. In fact, he wrote a chapter in my book. And the man is brilliant. But hopefully his type of chemosensitivity testing will be accepted in the years to come.
I want to talk about other case studies in the next hour. As we approach the break, though, I just want to touch on a couple of things here. And one is, let's talk statistics and how relevant are statistics. So, for example, when a doctor says you have a 20% chance to live another 2 years, or you have 3 to 6 months to live, what does that really mean? Are they relevant?
In my opinion, they are not relevant. These are statistics that are based on tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. And statistics concern large groups. They don't concern individuals. So when somebody is told they have cancer and they go through the standard of care, chemo, radiation, and or surgery, and it doesn't work, and the cancer progresses, and the cancer metastasizes, that's what most people do. They utilize standard of care. But there are those who say, you know what, there's got to be some other things out there. And if you can find other treatments and therapies, sophisticated individuals who bring other treatments and therapies to the table, and progressive chemo, whether it's chemosensitivity testing like this, combined with a particular type of distribution methodology and things to mitigate toxicity, which is not what standard of care utilizes, then you can enhance your chances dramatically. Now, let me be honest, there's no guarantees in life. There's no guarantees with cancer. There is no silver bullet. But standard of care utilizes the silver bullet approach. Go kill the cancer and you'll be okay. But that really is not reality, because lots of times cancer comes back with a vengeance. But regarding statistics, you got a 20% chance to live. Really, you're an individual. How you approach things individually is different how the masses approach things. And when a doctor says to you, I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do, I would assume, and I don't have statistics to prove this, but I would assume most people say, well, the doctor said you've only got 2 months to live. We need to get our affairs in order. But there's a subset of people out there, thousands, because I've met about 500, who can find other therapies that are on the cutting edge, that may be 20 years ahead of the curve. And the science frequently is 10, 15, and 20 years ahead of what clinicians, in other words, doctors, prescribe to individuals. And if we can find, and you can find sophisticated doctors who are ahead of the curve, who will implement these therapies, you can save your life, lengthen your life, enhance quality of life many times. Not always, but many, many times. Standard of care is too rigid. It's flawed because it's very narrow-minded. It's myopic. And there's other things we can bring to the table. So don't let that pronouncement, that fatalistic pronouncement, to send you to your bed, to draw the blinds, put your pillow, your head under the pillow. There is hope. I'm here to tell you this hope, because I've been to so many conferences and talked to experts around the planet who are treating people and saving lives.
When we come back, we'll hear about another terminal cancer patient who beat the odds.